the ongoing effort to alleviate hunger here at home and mixing history with the haunts you'll only find in the cities. On this Halloween weekend, we will look a little deeper at the ghosts that are still roaming the streets of the cities. Ooh. That's just ahead, but first, we are in the home stretch of the 2025 Student Hunger Drive, where food donations that add up to hundreds of thousands of meals really makes a big difference to the food pantries that exist throughout eastern Iowa and western Illinois. Now, the food drive is nearing its 40th year, dating back to the depths of the ag equipment recession of the 1980s here in the cities. So what's different today? We're joined by the Riverbend Food Bank's president and CEO, Chris Ford, and the organization's community engagement director, Jana Gallagher. Chris and Jana, thank you so much for joining us. We always talk about the energy of the Student Hunger Drive. And I always think it's interesting because other cities try to replicate this, because it was a germ of an idea back in the 1980s, and it just has so much energy even today.
It does. Pete Pullman actually started Student Hunger Drive.
That's right.
Of Lou Jack's. Yes. Yeah, so we're in year 39, and we officially kicked off on September 29th. And for 6 weeks, these kids will be creative, inventive, and they will be hosting various fundraising events throughout the campaign. You may see them in front of grocery stores soliciting food and funds. But yes, they continue to amaze me with how creative they get in their events, hosting haunted houses, utilizing their football games. They're using the community for the support.
We're talking about 750,000 meals, more than that. I mean, we got up to 800,000 meals as a record. You're nodding because you want to talk about that.
I do. We challenge these students to raise enough funds and food to provide 1 million meals, which seems really lofty. It is certainly not unattainable. And I have no doubt that we will likely meet that this year.
Well, Chris, explain to me what 1 million meals is. I mean, it's hard to figure out exactly, wrap your mind around that.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about a community or a service area where we're trying to feed 137,000 people, 1 million meals goes a long way. I would ask people to think about not having those 1 million meals, and I think it is certainly has much more of an effect that way. So the Student Hunger Drive has always been the largest event that we've had, and certainly couldn't do what we do without the students.
What about the timing? Because I think the second biggest fundraiser, is that still with the U.S. Postal Service? That's like in late spring, like May?
Yep, we do a postal drive. We also do Women Fighting Hunger events. Yep, those are two of the other events that we do have, yes.
But this one comes just before the holidays. And so how critically important is it at this time of year to be getting, you know, 700,000, 800,000, perhaps even 1 million meals?
Yeah, I think you make a very appropriate comment there. Certainly November and December are times when families are gathering, meals are had together, food needs to be provided. So this certainly is a key source of that.
Well, and you look at your warehouse before and after, because I've been in warehouses before you moved to your Davenport location when it was in Moline, and you would see what it looked like before you had the Student Hunger Drive, and then you saw it afterwards, and it was simply night and day.
Yeah, I think load-in day is probably one of the funnest days for employees at the food bank, and I would say one of the things, you know, that Jane and I agree upon about the Student Hunger Drive is that it actually re-energizes our organization. We see that transformation of students and the excitement and activity that they have, and that translates to our employees, and then culminates in that load-in day where we basically shut down our operations, and for one full day we're just unloading food and, again, getting to see the kids come and be excited and participate. And so yeah, it is just a great time.
This is also a huge educational component to this.
Yes.
You're also teaching young teens about food insecurity.
We are. So there is an educational component to the whole campaign. And this year we reimagined how that has looked in years past. I spent most of September going into the schools and teaching a lead to feed educational piece, do a little bit of programming. We give a state of the food bank, right? We want them to, they're our brand ambassadors for 6 weeks. They need to understand how vital it is, what they're doing in our community. So we do educate them about SNAP benefits, not only what they are, what they provide, how great of a tool that is for fighting food insecurity, but what are the ramifications of federal funding cuts to that program and how it translates into what they do for us for 6 weeks. So it is an educational piece, but it also instills philanthropy. I mean, these are our change makers, and these kids use this campaign as a jumping point to move into what they're doing after college. They use this on their college resumes. Like, it really is, it does carry with them after they leave high school.
I did want to touch on that in particular, because it is changing. We're up to almost 40 years of the student hunger drive. So some of these people that were in the first hunger drive are in their 50s and their 60s.
Yes.
And so do you think these lessons last beyond high school?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we could challenge any number of our volunteers at our pantries who likely have participated in Student Hunger Drive. We know for a fact that a former Bettendorf student went on to help start a college pantry at Iowa State University. So it does carry with them.
Explain to me, Chris, the need right now. We're seeing cutbacks. We know that SNAP benefits are always in play. There's no farm bill that is been approved yet, and that's such a vital part or a massive part of that bill. There's so much uncertainty for so many people right now.
Yeah, uncertainty is a great word. I think that's the word I would pick. If you ask about the current situation right now, we are at a four-year high in terms of food insecurity rates. So in our service area, that's about 13.2%.
So explain that to me again, a four-year high?
Yes.
So that takes you back to the pandemic?
Yep, right into right after the pandemic, I believe.
All right.
Yes. So roughly, again, 137,000 people, in a 23-county service area.
And when you're talking about food insecurity, I mean, it's a clever word that people use, but they don't necessarily know what that means.
Yeah.
It generally means you're not necessarily certain where your next meal's coming from.
That is absolutely correct. In the simplest form, you don't know where your next meal's coming from. Yes.
And so we're seeing numbers as high, if not higher, than once the pandemic was over.
That is correct. Numbers across the nation are high. Every single one of our 23 counties has the highest food insecurity rate. And so obviously overall, we're still experiencing the issues that come along with that.
And as always the case, of those 23 counties in Eastern Iowa and Western Illinois, so many of them, if not the majority of them by far, are rural counties. And food access is very difficult. We always talk about food deserts as well. Food access is very difficult in rural areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, when you talk about, you mentioned SNAP before, and when you talk about rural areas, most people have the misconception that food insecurity is highest in like metropolitan areas. It's actually not true. About 80% of the leading areas where food insecurity is the highest are in rural areas. So when you put that, combine that together with the fact that most of those people in those areas are on a SNAP program, and then you take away SNAP funding, the formula you begin to see is the elimination of independent grocery stores, lack of economic activity, and the creation of food deserts. So it is a full circle cycle that comes around, and we are very concerned about that, because obviously where our service area lies in the country, a lot of our areas are rural areas.
Well, and you're really talking about a domino effect.
Absolutely.
The other thing is that the people that may not understand, it's called a food bank for a reason. You are the distribution center. Under you are all of those food pantries that may be in a small city library, it may be in a church basement, it may be at a shelter or a location. Are you seeing, and all volunteer too, so are you seeing problems at that level of being able to sustain these food pantries? Even if there is food, there may not be the volunteers, or sometimes even more importantly, the space.
Yeah, I think all those things are a consideration. Certainly, volunteers are aging out. People who have typically run those pantries are getting older and not necessarily haven't backfilled the volunteers to be able to run that. I think consistently we hear funding. Funding is an issue. So we are working collaboratively now with a lot of those organizations to try to help them raise funds so they can purchase food. You talk about space. A lot of them don't have, you know, the amenities that they need. We do work with several manufacturers, though, where we can provide not only refrigerators but also freezers. So there's a lot of things we can do to build capacity. But I would say it is an extremely tough situation right now for our hunger relief partners.
Do you think the students get that? Do the students, because I mean, some of them may be receiving food or some of their friends that they may not have ever realized that before.
Yes, and that is part of that lead to feed component. We have over 75 school pantries, so we know that these students are maybe personally utilizing our services or have a classmate. When there are one in six students facing food insecurity, it is very likely that their classmates are aware of that.
Because you talk about the excitement, because I think a lot of people, also a lot of kids, might just get involved because it's a fun thing. And you do want it to be a fun thing.
Yes.
But it is so much more.
It is so much more. And I think those numbers are really tangible for these young adults to understand. One in eight adults and one in six children facing food insecurity. When you break it down like that, that is a little more palatable for them. And I like to stress to them, because it has been expressed to me, some of these high need schools, you know, it's hard for them to ask their students to bring in food or money when they know in fact that they are the ones in need. But I encourage them to change the narrative a little bit, in that that is why what they're doing is so vital. They are helping their classmates, their own community, and you know, how great of a joy is that, to be helping your classmates.
And of course, so much of the food that's donated is non-perishable. So you do like to also see the monetary donations, because it allows you to buy other things that are greatly in need.
Yeah, absolutely. Financial donations are important, really, because it allows us to buy nutritional food. Food that's donated to us, we are very grateful for, but we can't control the nutritional value of that food. And we think it's really important that people not only receive food, but receive nutritional food. So when people support us financially, that gives us the flexibility to buy what people need.
And let's be honest, at this point right now, to what extent is there the education process on the other end? The people that are giving, the children that are collecting, they're learning. The people that are receiving, are they learning as well? Because there's been such a push to make sure that the food that is being delivered and the food that's being consumed is higher quality, is more healthy, is more beneficial to children.
Yeah, I would say I can't answer for sure if they're learning from that, but what I can tell you is that they are grateful. Anytime I visit any of our pantries, the amount of thank yous and gratitude that I see from people makes me understand why I come back to work each day. The fulfillment there is pretty incredible. So I do think, I'm not sure about the learning side, Jim, but definitely the gratitude side.
And let's talk a little bit more about those people who do receive help at food pantries throughout our area. As you well know, I mean, there's people that think, that's not for me. You know, that's just, I would never accept food like that. How important is it for people just almost to break down that barrier and say, this is not a question of pride?
Yeah, I think that is the stigma that has been fought for years and continues to be fought, is that food pantries are, you know, you can't go there for help. I think it was maybe a generational thing. And I think through the education of kids and programs like the Student Hunger Drive, as we begin to educate and tell people it's okay to reach out for help, it is becoming more acceptable.
The finale rally is November 6th. The big loading day, I believe, is November 7th then, right?
Fifth.
Oh, it's the day before, of course. Finale is the day after. There is so much energy and excitement. I love finale day.
Yes.
You got to be looking forward to that as well.
I cannot wait. My cheeks were sore a week after the kickoff, so I am already anticipating an incredible evening. That is a night we will come together and announce how many meals were raised from the students, but also part of our Million Meals Match initiative that we launched this year, where we're asking our community to come alongside these students and also raise enough money to provide a million meals. So we are a little over halfway there, and I am so excited to be able to share the news on finale of what our community has also done alongside these students.
You think you're gonna do it?
I know we can do
it.
You
know you're gonna do it. One more thing is, I know we're in the middle of the 39th. You must be planning already from 1986 to 2026 for the 40th anniversary of Student Hunger Drive.
It is, the wheels are in motion. It is a cause for celebration. You know, I think Pete Pullman showed up last year. I know his daughters are involved with the school still. So there's nothing definite set in stone, but we have a lot of community supporters who definitely want to be a part of that, and we hope to do it up big.
Well, and Chris, I just think that this was created in 1986, at the depth of the, I'll just say the depression for the farm implement business. And this area was so hard hit. And the events, I mean, Festival of Trees started in that period of time to raise money for the arts. Student Hunger Drive started in that. And we're still seeing the need, even today, some 40 years later.
Yeah, I think that's definitely disappointing. I think as an organization, that's one of the challenges we're taking on. We're trying to find out, we're actually implementing a new system in our hunger relief partners called Link to Feed. And we're simply asking questions on, why are you here? And I think for so many years, food banking was about giving people food. Now it's become, let's ask the question, why are you here? Can you not pay a utility bill? Or do you have medical bills? Is it a housing issue? We have great relationships with other nonprofits, so we can get people the help they need, and that's the only way we're ever going to shorten the line. So I'm really encouraged that our organization is actively pursuing that strategy, and I hope, you know, 3 to 5 years from now, as we begin to have all that data to be able to utilize, that we will begin to see an end to four-year highs in food insecurity rates.
And the students will be a big part of that.
Absolutely.
Our thanks to Riverbend Food Bank's president and CEO, Chris Ford, and the organization's community engagement director, Jaina Gallagher. Just ahead, pulling back the curtain to find out about those ghosts that lurk in the cities. But first, events that won't give you a fright. Thanks to Visit Quad City.
Check out the things to do this week in the Quad Cities. Celebrate science, inventions, art, and history as you explore the amazing museums in our regional destination. Next, river cruise season is almost over, so make sure you spend an evening on board. Then head to the Speakeasy in the Circa 21 Dinner Playhouse to watch the Rocky Horror Show. Then get ready for the Fall Harvest Festival. Enjoy live music, food, and family-friendly fun. Finally, celebrate the Day of the Dead at the Figge Art Museum. There will be music, food, and dance. For more events like these, check out our events calendar at visitquadcities.com.
The cities has a history that is unique, of course, to this area, and there are plenty of ghost stories that go along with it. It has been a passion of Minda Powers Douglas for years. Now, she created QC Haunts and History and joined us to tell us the tales of the lost souls from the past.
You're obsessed? You're so... When did you get interested in ghosts?
Oh my gosh, forever.
Yeah.
Forever ago.
So you're a believer.
Oh yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt. Yeah, getting angry at a ghost really solidified it, because that ghost really, oh, she done me wrong. But since I was a kid, I've always loved ghost stories and books. I mean, even now, I'm looking through the books. I work at a library. I'm like, okay, where are the horror books, and where the one, I always want the best ghost story I can find. Looking back, I realized that an imaginary friend of mine was probably a ghost. So, shout out Robin, wherever you are.
Well, and the group that you have is called QC Haunts and History.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that's really interesting because when you take a look at history of the Quad Cities, it is rich.
Oh, yeah.
And it is bawdy.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Because we could talk about Bucktown and what that was in Davenport.
Yes.
And we could talk about the gangster and loony era in Rock Island. So let's do that. Let's talk about the loony era, because that was when the gangsters ran the city.
Oh, yeah.
The two competing newspapers, there was gunfire between them. The gunfire at the police station, breaking out prisoners there. Mm-hmm. It was a lawless period of time, and those ghosts are still walking the streets of Rock Island?
They are. I actually tell people I have a ghost guarantee for the Rock Island tour, because the second you say John Looney's name when you're down there, his henchmen come out like, "What are you doing talking about our boss?" And they follow the tour around to a certain point. They go about halfway through, and then they're like, eh, because you're not going to talk about it much after that. But they're still working. There's one story where I'm talking about how this poor gentleman was thrown out a window by them, and they're laughing out the window at us. I'm like, you're still dead.
Yeah, you're still stuck in that
You're stuck, and you think it's funny that, you know, we're talking about you, but I know all this because I had some really amazing mediums that volunteered for the tour one year. It was just all of a sudden this group of people, wonderful group of people, came together as volunteers, and we had a ton of fun. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, the gangsters are all there. John Looney doesn't make his presence known very often, but he's there. Sometimes the henchmen are there. Connor Looney, he's there, unfortunately. And
you're saying one of the most haunted buildings that you've ever been in is actually on the one way in Rock Island.
Yeah.
It used to be the old YMCA. It's the Viner Warehouse, the big big brick building.
Still.
What do you mean? How's that the most haunted?
I guess per square foot. I mean, at least for me, and understanding what's going on over there. The medium that I know who's been in there. Her name's Linda, and she knows a lot about the history of the building as well as the haunted aspects of the building. But, you know, she'll look down the hallway and there's all these heads popping out of the rooms because they're all still there in the dormitory area.
Why do these ghosts exist? Why are they stuck in time? Why are they scaring the bejesus out of people?
You know, I don't know. I think in certain situations, like there's a number of the ladies of the evening who are stuck in that building because they're afraid. There's a lot of the thugs, the henchmen that kind of keep them there. They scare them.
So their souls are still there.
They're kind of stuck. There's also some very kind souls there. There's a little boy that's there. My daughter's got she's got a lot of sensitivity. So I've got a bunch of pictures of her being in there, and she's holding her hand out to the side. Mm. She's holding his hand. And she feels little fingers on her hand. And then we sat down once, and she's like, "I think he's sitting on my lap," because she could feel just like a little tiny ghost butt right there.
So tell me about, because you give tours, of course, to adults, but you have children's tours too.
Yeah, I do.
Which are not as bawdy.
No, I leave the brothels out of those. Yeah, and the gunfire. I just go with some other ones.
And the tours, because we're talking to you during the Halloween season, of course. And
it's my season.
Yeah, but I mean, they're around all the time. You're giving these tours throughout the year. So if somebody's interested in getting a tour, learning some interesting history.
Oh, yeah, it's all history.
Yeah, learning all about that. Yeah. Tell me, how do they contact you?
Go to qchaunts.com and go on there. Yeah, people just, I do them on demand. So if there's, even right now, I have tours on the weekends, but if somebody said, hey, I can't do the weekends or I can't do, you know, a certain time of the day, I'll schedule something for them during the week or Sunday afternoons, anything like that.
And you got both sides of the river. It's not just the Illinois Quad Cities. There's some scary people in Davenport too, right?
There are probably a lot of scary people in the Bucktown area. I haven't even gone down there. I'm not sure if the German-American History Center goes that far with their tour, because they do one as well. But I'm over at the Village of East Davenport, and there is a number of that one's like Civil War and beyond.
Because of the training that was going on across the street at the park, so that, of course, would be a place where you would see some Civil War activity.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they're stuck there, too. I think some people get stuck. And then there's another spirit in downtown Rock Island at Ribco, and he likes to be there. Not probably right now, since it's been closed for a while, but it was his happy place, and that's where he went to afterward. Cause it's a good place. It's always a good place.
Yeah. So if you're a ghost, where do you want to be stuck?
Stuck in one place?
Maybe
I don't travel. Whitey's would probably be good. I don't know. I wouldn't be down in downtown Rock Island just because the thugs are there.
From way back when.
They're so annoying.
Thanks for sharing your stories with us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Anytime.
Our thanks to Minda Powers Douglas from QC Haunts and History for joining us. And you can contact her at qchaunts.com. Our founding fathers had a spark of an idea that created a nation. And as we mark the 250th birthday of Independence Day, we're asking fellow citizens about their civic spark. What makes their career a part of the fabric of the cities? Here's State Senator Mike Halpin with his civic spark.
Yeah, I do what I do because I'm trying to help people on a day-by-day basis and try to make their lives just a little bit easier with the problem that they're trying to deal with that day. And I think it's important to do that in addition to the legislative side. It's important that we uphold these institutions of democracy that have served us so well for the last 250 years. And I don't want to be the guy that weakens that. I don't want to be the guy that gave up on our democratic traditions that we've established through war and blood and tears. I want to be the guy that continues that tradition of being a place where anyone can speak their mind, anyone can petition their government, and everyone has the right to vote and to decide what that government's going to look like.
Our thanks to State Senator Mike Halpin of the Quad Cities. On the air, on the radio, on the web, on your mobile device, and streaming on your computer, thanks for taking some time to join us as we talk about the issues on the cities.